bleeding, and an X-ray confirming viral lung involvement. His clinical picture actually appeared to be very much an influenza that had become complicated by viral pneumonia. In addition to bed rest and aspirin, the patient received only 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously daily for 3 days. Dalton termed the response excellent, noting the return of strength on the 4th day and the patient's return to work on the 5th day. Another of Dalton's cases, a 47-year-old woman, also had severe symptomatic disease, with exhaustion limiting her to bed, loss of appetite, and generalized chest pain. Dalton termed her completely debilitated. Over the next 15 days, she received a total of 6 2,000-milligram injections of vitamin C. No other medications were given. After only the 2nd injection, she was feeling better, and she was insistent on receiving additional injections. Of particular interest in this case was that this patient had a history of recurrent bouts of pneumonia, although in this instance, her condition improved much more rapidly than it ever had before. Dalton described a 41-year-old man who had headache, generalized muscular aching, and exhaustion. Clinically, he was felt to have acute viral pneumonia, and the clinical description again suggested a diagnosis of influenza complicated by pneumonia. The patient was given a 2,000-milligram injection of vitamin C for 3 consecutive days. Seen in a follow-up a week later, he was found to be symptom-free, and he had already returned to work a couple of days earlier. Dalton also treated a 72-year-old man for what he termed a general viremia. 3 2,000-milligram vitamin C injections were given over an 11-day period, and a marked improvement in the presenting symptoms was noted. While the descriptions of Dalton's cases are not as impressive as those of Klenner, significant responses were still obtained with a much less aggressive dosing of vitamin C. It also reinforces the importance of having as much of the vitamin C given by needle as possible. It is very doubtful Dalton would have seen equivalent patient responses with the same number of 2,000-milligram vitamin C doses given orally. Viral pneumonia is another infection readily curable by vitamin C. Adequate daily doses of vitamin C should also prove effective in preventing it from being contracted in the first place. Influenza, curable and preventable. Influenza, flu, is a very common viral infection that is often associated with or evolves from a head cold. Even though influenza can sometimes also affect the lungs and resemble viral pneumonia, it should be noted that viral pneumonia primarily affects the lungs, while influenza seems to affect more of the body in general. Diffuse muscular pain is especially characteristic of influenza, accompanying the less specific symptoms of headache, weakness, fever, and chills. While no traditional treatments are known to cure influenza, ranitidine and amantadine are antiviral drugs that are felt to lessen symptoms and speed recovery in uncomplicated cases. Klenner did not specifically detail his vitamin C treatment of influenza. Probably one reason for this was because he had reported such profound successes with so many other advanced and life-threatening viral diseases. Certainly curing a comatose patient with encephalitis or eliminating the paralysis of a polio patient must have had precedence over Klenner's vitamin C experience with the flu. Klenner did say, however, that he treated many cases of influenza with vitamin C. He also implied complete success with this disease as well, commenting only that the size of the dose and the number of injections of vitamin C needed were directly related to the fever response to therapy and to the duration of the disease. Magna reported on the vitamin C treatment of 130 cases of influenza. Males and females, ranging in age from 10 to 40 years, were treated. Treatment was given for 1 to 3 days with doses of vitamin C up to 45,000 milligrams. In spite of this variable approach, Magna reported good success, with 114 recovering and only 16 not significantly responding. As has already been seen repeatedly in Klenner's work, failing to provide an adequate dose of vitamin C can be expected to show little or no clinical effect. Another virus, somewhat akin to the influenza virus, is the one that causes the dog and cat distemper complex. Distemper is an infectious disease of the respiratory tract and sometimes the gastrointestinal tract with associated fever, dullness, loss of appetite, and discharge from the eyes and nose. When dogs and cats get sick enough with distemper and do not recover spontaneously, they are often put to sleep. As with so many human viral infections, this animal viral disease is readily and easily curable with adequate doses of vitamin C. Belfield reported excellent results in the treatment of 12 dogs and cats. He generally gave dogs 2,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C each day for 3 days. For cats and small dogs, he gave 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously per day for 3 days. All 12 animals recovered completely, even though 2 of them had been given no hope of recovery by other veterinarians. Amazingly, the editor made some explanatory comments at the start of Belfield's article to justify its publication, stating that veterinarians were still plagued by the age-old problem of what to do with the dog that is already sick with distemper. It was also noted that editors were especially inclined to view this subject as a hot potato and to apply themselves to less controversial matters. Obviously, anticipating negative feedback from Belfield's article, the editor added that the chuckles of our friends in research as they read these words could almost be heard. In a defensive posture, the editor challenged his readers not to brand the journal editors as cracked or the reporting clinicians as quacks, but to keep their minds open. The editor asserted that the fate of the unattended distemper-sick dog is well known, and euthanasia just doesn't carry the professional dignity it did 25 years ago. This editor realized that readers of his journal did not have the most open of minds, but that the information still had to be published. If science is not open-minded, it has no dignity and little validity. Motivated by the clinical successes reported by Belfield in 1967, Livek decided to start treating his dogs suffering from distemper with vitamin C. Livek treated a total of 67 cases of canine distemper complex, and he also reported very good results. He commented that recovery from this disease can be markedly improved by including vitamin C in the treatment regimen. Klenner was able to later corroborate Belfield's work. Klenner noted that he had cured many dogs suffering with distemper by giving injections of several grams of vitamin C every 2 hours. Klenner also noted that vitamin C had been discounted as being of little or no value against distemper, since dogs are animals that can make their own vitamin C. However, dogs and cats cannot produce the massive amounts of vitamin C that some wild animals can make, and Klenner demonstrated repeatedly in his work that many viral infections will not show a positive response until a certain threshold of vitamin C administration is reached. This means that dogs and cats can only be expected to protect themselves from mild viral and infectious challenges. Large challenges, however, can rapidly and irreversibly sicken them if additional amounts of vitamin C are not forthcoming. The ability of vitamin C to effectively treat the influenza virus is consistent with the fact that significant influenza infections are associated with a great deal of oxidative stress, a condition ideally suited for the potent antioxidant properties of vitamin C. Buffington et al. Showed that an influenza virus infection in mice was associated with increased oxidative stress in the lungs. In a similar experimental model, Hennett et al. Also showed that influenza-infected mice had lowered levels of vitamin C and an overall lowered antioxidant status. This is especially significant since mice readily synthesize substantial amounts of their own vitamin C. It would appear that a virus such as the influenza virus can rapidly overwhelm the resistance of even a vitamin C synthesizing animal like the mouse. This further underscores the need to supplement vitamin C promptly and in very high doses to effectively combat influenza and other viral diseases. Although reported in less detail than some of the other viral diseases, it nevertheless appears that influenza responds rapidly to optimal vitamin C dosing. Some of the viral diseases cured by Klenner and others were most likely mixed viral combinations that included influenza. As was noted earlier, mixed viral syndromes generally have a greater viral load and require more intensive vitamin C therapy. Therefore, any time that Klenner cured a mixed viral syndrome that included influenza viruses, it is probably reasonable to conclude that the influenza virus alone could have been eradicated with less aggressive vitamin C dosing. Influenza is yet another viral disease that is curable, and adequate maintenance vitamin C should easily prevent it from ever being contracted in the first place. Rabies. Preventable, curable, reversible, Rabies is an especially feared viral disease that results in a relentless and almost invariably fatal encephalitis. The incubation period preceding development of initial symptoms is unusually long, averaging from 1 to 2 months. Traditional therapy is directed at attempting to prevent the viral penetration of the nervous system after initial exposure to the virus, using vaccines and other forms of immunotherapy. The Cecil Textbook of Medicine asserts that rabies cannot be cured once the disease has already invaded the nervous system. Klenner did not report on the treatment of any rabies patients in his publications. As might be expected, considering the successes he had with so many other viral diseases, Klenner was very adamant that the administration of the proper amounts of vitamin C would destroy all viruses encountered. The only failures that Klenner ever had were overcome by giving more vitamin C, often by the intravenous route. Amato demonstrated that the rabies virus could be inactivated, killed, by vitamin C. Much later, Banach studied the effects of vitamin C on the rabies virus with guinea pigs. With 48 animals in the test group using vitamin C and 50 animals as a control group without vitamin C, Banach found a statistically significant greater survival rate among the vitamin C-treated animals versus those who received no vitamin C. He concluded that vitamin C was effective in the prevention of rabies. Banach also noted that no therapeutic effect for continued vitamin C usage was achieved in animals that had already developed paralysis. However, Banach used only 100 milligrams of vitamin C per kilogram animal body weight, administered intramuscularly twice daily for 7 days. Recall that Klenner would use as much as 700 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C per kilogram body weight in some of his patients. Also, Klenner's dosing would be repeated as often as every 2 hours until a favorable clinical response appeared. Furthermore, Klenner would often add significant amounts of oral vitamin C to go along with the intravenous doses. Had Banach used a more aggressive dosing of vitamin C, his results could certainly have been even more dramatic. When one considers that variable degrees of paralysis associated with other viral diseases were also completely reversed by Klenner-sized doses of vitamin C, higher dosing by Banach could likely have salvaged some of the animals even after the paralysis had developed. In any event, there is absolutely no justification for not treating all rabies victims with high doses of intravenous vitamin C. Even if the medical practitioner still wants to heed the present recommendations of using an extended vaccine therapy that is highly toxic in itself, the co-administration of vitamin C should be mandatory. Even though rabies certainly appears to be a preventable disease, The studies simply have not been conducted that would justify calling rabies either a reversible or a curable disease with the administration of vitamin C. However, this would appear to be due only to the lack of documented attempts to treat rabies with large doses of intravenous vitamin C. There is no reason to suspect that rabies would not respond in as equally dramatic a fashion as the other life-threatening viral diseases already discussed. AIDS. Reversible and preventable. Curable? Question mark. In the approximately 2 decades of its known existence, the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS, has arguably become the most widely recognized disease syndrome in the history of the planet. AIDS is the disease that commonly eventually develops in those who become infected with the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. The worldwide epidemic of HIV-infected individuals has shown no signs of significant slowing, except in areas where a large percentage of the population has already become infected. Consider the following figures from the World Health Organization, WHO. In 1991, the WHO estimated that there were 8 to 10 million HIV-infected persons in the world. The WHO increased this estimate to 12 to 14 million HIV infections in 1993. The WHO estimated the number of cases would be up to 36 million by the end of the year 2000. The WHO also estimated that 3 million people would die in 2000, as 2.6 million had already died in 1999. Although the majority of deaths from earlier infections and new infections continues to occur in Africa, the rest of the world should not feel safe from this virus. Like any other virus, HIV attacks and infects those with the weakest immune systems. Poor nutrition and poor general health are always precursors to any viral infection. Furthermore, the amount of vitamin C taken daily and subsequently stored in the body will also be a primary determinant as to whether HIV or any other virus takes hold inside the body. Therefore, even though viruses like HIV and Ebola, for another example, can be pandemic in many of the starving, weakened African nations, they will also attack nutritionally and immunologically deficient people anywhere else in the world. Cathcart reported on his experience in treating AIDS patients with vitamin C. His results clearly indicate that AIDS and HIV infection are preventable and reversible conditions, and he postulates that the cure of AIDS might be possible if aggressive vitamin C therapy is continued for a long enough period of time. The reversibility of AIDS with vitamin C can vary from minimal symptom alleviation and reversal to a complete suppression of AIDS-associated symptoms. This complete suppression is distinguished from a cure, however, as the AIDS syndrome will typically reappear when Cathcart's suggested high-dose maintenance regimen of vitamin C is either discontinued or significantly cut back. Although Cathcart did occasionally use intravenous vitamin C in treating AIDS, his most consistent administration of vitamin C was by mouth. He found that roughly 50,000 to 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C as ascorbic acid powder daily could suppress the symptoms of many AIDS patients. Not surprisingly, he also found that this dosage level of vitamin C markedly reduced the incidence of secondary infections in the AIDS patients. Such infections are often the immediate causes of death in AIDS, and they are also responsible for much of the suffering associated with the disease. Also, even though these patients were sustaining good symptom relief, the helper T cell, an important immune cell, count would still show evidence of being suppressed, even when the high-dose vitamin C protocol had resolved the clinical symptoms. This indicated an ongoing control of the disease process, but not a cure. Cathcart first described the method of adjusting vitamin C dosage according to bowel tolerance. Oral vitamin C, whether as ascorbic acid or as an ascorbate salt like sodium ascorbate, will reliably cause a watery diarrhea when a large enough dose is given. This occurs when a high concentration of unabsorbed vitamin C manages to reach the lower bowel and rectum. The high concentration of vitamin C naturally draws fluid into it from the surrounding tissues, resulting in a large volume of fluid in the rectum, which generally requires urgent evacuation. This process is also one of the reasons that large amounts of purified water must be faithfully ingested during this process. Significant fluid loss can occur in short order, and vitamin C exerts its own mild diuretic, urine production stimulating action as well. Only rarely will vitamin C ever manifest negative side effects, but when it does, it is often because a patient who is dehydrated simply will not ingest enough water and fluids. Cathcart also found that stressful conditions of any kind, but especially viral infections, would greatly increase the utilization rate of vitamin C in the body. Such stressful conditions would allow a patient to take vastly more vitamin C orally than would normally trigger the diarrhea response. The vitamin C depleted individual absorbs enough of the vitamin C in the early segments of the gut so that a high enough concentration to cause the diarrhea never reaches the lower gut. As a general rule, the sicker or more stressed the patient, the more vitamin C will be absorbed and utilized before enough of it reaches the lower gut or colon and stimulates the diarrhea reaction. Cathcart reported that over a 10-year period, he had treated more than 9,000 patients with vitamin C doses using this concept of bowel tolerance. AIDS was one of the diseases treated by Cathcart with vitamin C that consistently showed the highest bowel tolerances. In other words, AIDS showed an ability to utilize and metabolize vitamin C more rapidly than most other diseases, infectious or otherwise. Probably only an acute and massive viral infection such as Ebola would consistently require more. From his experience in the vitamin C treatment of over 250 HIV-positive patients, including ones with full-blown AIDS, Cathcart was able to outline some fairly well-defined patterns of response. Not surprisingly, he noted that clinical improvements seemed proportional to the amount of vitamin C given and relative to how clinically ill the patient was at the beginning of treatment. Cathcart asserted that any AIDS patient could be put into remission if enough vitamin C is taken to neutralize the toxicity of the disease process, and any secondary infections are adequately treated. Furthermore, Cathcart noted that the CD4 cell count, an important immune cell that is depleted in HIV-infected patients, often responds positively to the vitamin C therapy. The depletion of the CD4 count can be slowed, stopped, or even reversed for several years when vitamin C is dosed optimally. This is especially significant since the CD4 count is an important indicator of immediate prognosis. When it drops below a certain level and it does not rebound, any of several life-threatening infections can be contracted at any time. When AIDS patients presented to Cathcart in a critically ill fashion, for example, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, or with a widely disseminated additional viral infection such as herpes or cytomegalovirus, he would give as much as 180,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously per day, until there was enough clinical stability to switch to oral maintenance vitamin C therapy. Like Klenner, the oral vitamin C would typically be initiated at the outset along with the intravenous therapy. Cathcart would also start with the intravenous administration if the patient had a stomach condition that would not allow significant amounts of vitamin C, as ascorbic acid, to be given orally. As the overall condition of the patient improved, the oral dosing would usually become better tolerated. To prevent relapses, Cathcart emphasized the importance of educating the patient as to the lifelong need for high-dose oral vitamin C as determined by bowel tolerance. Cathcart also noted that AIDS could be a syndrome in which eliminating the virus completely might not necessarily eliminate the disease. Just as juvenile onset diabetes is felt to be possibly due to virus-facilitated damage to the insulin-secreting cells of the pancreas, AIDS may represent a form of incurable damage to the immune system. But even if this is the case, there is probably still good reason to believe that all cases of AIDS might not have sustained the same levels of permanent damage to the immune system. Therefore, completely eliminating the offending virus might still result in cures for some patients. Cathcart suggests that giving a minimum of 180,000 milligrams of vitamin C intravenously daily for at least 2 weeks while simultaneously taking bowel tolerance doses of vitamin C orally may very well completely eliminate HIV and even lead to a clinical cure of AIDS. He does add, however, that this regimen was not successful in curing at least one AIDS patient on whom it was tried. In general, all acute viral syndromes can probably be cured with prompt and vigorous vitamin C therapy. However, when some viral infections are not immediately and definitively addressed and become chronic, the disease processes are no longer pathologically the same as when they were acute. Consequences such as secondary damage to tissues and the provocation of autoimmune reactions not seen with acute infections can change the basic disease process. This, in turn, can change the response to vitamin C and any other medication or treatment. However, if the opportunity exists, any AIDS patients would be best served by going on a prolonged daily regimen of high-dose intravenous vitamin C, perhaps for a month or more, before transferring to daily maintenance on oral vitamin C at bowel tolerance levels for life. One possible reason that AIDS is so much more difficult to completely eradicate than other viral infections is because of harboring of the virus in the CD4 lymphocytes mentioned earlier. The Cecil Textbook of Medicine notes that approximately 1 million lymphocytes having the CD4 antigen in any given infected person contain stably integrated provirus in a latent state. Provirus is the nucleic acid, DNA or RNA, of the infecting virus that has actually been integrated into the chromosome of the patient's host cells. This allows it to be reproduced indefinitely along with the rest of the cell's DNA every time cell replication takes place. However, until the CD4 cell is activated by any of several stimuli, the viral nucleic acid will not again be activated to produce a complete virus. As a result, this reservoir of inactive virus will remain much less accessible to any therapy, including vitamin C. Logic dictates that the intravenous administration of vitamin C would be required to extend beyond the lifetimes of the CD4 cell and any other cells of the body in which the virus might have become incorporated. The administration of vitamin C by vein would be expected to neutralize any viral DNA or RNA released by the dying cells. Otherwise, it would be expected to neutralize any viral particles that are reformed upon the release of the DNA or RNA. This same reasoning may apply to some of the cancers that are known to be associated with viral infections. The intravenous application of vitamin C may have to be continued for one or more months on a daily basis to result in the cure of some cancers. Less aggressive dosing may result in the improvement of clinical symptoms only, or in the achievement of a remission that could later relapse. As AIDS is a syndrome characterized by immune compromise, the potential for curing a case of AIDS with vitamin C would be optimized if identifiable sources of significant daily immune-suppressing toxins are also eliminated. Huggins and Levy, as well as other investigators, have long observed the enormous negative health impact of a daily exposure to potent dental toxins. Not only do such toxins directly utilize and metabolize a large amount of vitamin C that could otherwise be directed to the support of general health, but these toxins further exert their own unrelenting negative effect on the immune system and the body in general. Such dental toxins include mercury in amalgam fillings and the toxins of anaerobic bacterial metabolism found in root canal-treated teeth, cavitations, and gum periodontal disease. In addition, the toxicity of other biologically incompatible and toxic dental materials, such as the nickel in many crowns and braces, remain in the mouth for many years. If an AIDS patient can be relieved of this enormous daily toxic stress before undergoing the intensive course of vitamin C therapy outlined earlier, dramatic reversals and even clinical cures might become commonplace. A sizable amount of research has been performed that supports the benefits of vitamin C in HIV-infected patients. With regard to HIV-infected men, Tang et al. Reported that high intakes of several nutrients, niacin, vitamin C, and vitamin B1, were associated with slower progression to AIDS after adjustment for confounding variables. Allard et al. Were able to demonstrate that fairly small doses of oral vitamin C relative to the bowel tolerance doses used by Cathcart, along with vitamin E, showed positive effects. The administration of merely 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C and 800 international units of vitamin E daily for 3 months to HIV-infected patients resulted in a lessened evidence of oxidative stress and a trend toward reduction of the actual viral load. The authors, along with Kotler, suggest considering the routine use of antioxidants such as vitamin C and vitamin E in HIV-infected individuals, since only about 10% of those infected individuals can currently afford to buy the existing prescription AIDS drugs. Semba et al. Also reported that a deficiency of vitamin A seems to be an important risk factor for disease progression during HIV-1 infection. Certainly, it would seem wise to take reasonable daily doses of all the other antioxidant vitamins to help vitamin C's support of the immune system. Although Cathcart's extensive experience with very large doses of vitamin C in AIDS conclusively demonstrates that prolonged administration benefits the patients, including even raising the CD4 T lymphocyte cell count, research continues that attempts to discredit the benefits of vitamin C and discourage its use. Eiler et al., looking at purified human T cells in culture, found that incubating these cells with vitamin C in the test tube at variable concentrations damaged the cells in an irreversible fashion after an exposure of at least 18 hours. On this basis alone, these authors cautioned against the use of large doses of vitamin C in the treatment of patients with AIDS and cancer. Furthermore, the title of their article, which is all that many readers and reviewers often read, simply states that vitamin C is toxic and immunosuppressive to human T cells. The researchers never even mentioned that this effect was observed only in the test tube and not the body. A treatment period of only 18 hours is inconsequential, and any familiarity at all with the vitamin C ingestion of Cathcart's HIV-infected patients for years permits a total dismissal of the extremely over-extrapolated conclusion reached by these researchers. Test tube research can be very valuable, but it cannot always be directly correlated and applied to what happens inside the body. These researchers have an obligation to be aware of the volumes of positive clinical data already amassed before warning AIDS and cancer patients against the use of large doses of vitamin C, which is quite possibly the best therapeutic option available to them. Vitamin C has been demonstrated to kill HIV directly in both whole blood and in a culture medium. Raoul et al. Concluded that concentrations of vitamin C that completely inactivated HIV did not demonstrate any definable harmful effects. Furthermore, there was no negative effect seen on the platelets in the vitamin C-mediated HIV inactivation in the blood. Platelets are sticky elements in the blood that help to initiate blood clotting. The possibility exists that a routine addition of vitamin C to blood products to be transfused would not only disinfect them, but would also improve the nutrient benefit to the patient. Having a way to routinely eliminate HIV from blood and blood product transfusions would also effectively eliminate the occasional transfusion of HIV-tainted blood from a donor who had not yet developed HIV antibodies, which would allow the tainted blood to escape detection by routine testing. Such effective treatment of blood to be transfused could possibly completely eliminate the need for routinely checking such blood for infective agents. Cumming, et al., noted that the risk of such an unwelcome transfusion appears to be decreasing over time. However, such transfusions still occur, even though there is no satisfactory reason for not pre-treating the blood with vitamin C and significantly dosing the patient to be transfused with vitamin C before and after transfusion for added protection against any transmitted infection. In addition to its ability to kill HIV directly, as noted earlier, vitamin C has demonstrated the ability to be toxic to cells already infected with HIV. Rivas et al. Showed that exposure to pharmacological concentrations of vitamin C preferentially lessened the ability of HIV-infected cells to reproduce or survive. This effect resulted further in decreased viral production. Earlier, Harake et al. Indicated that concentrations of vitamin C not directly toxic to the infected cells still resulted in a significant inhibition of virus reproduction inside the cells. Furthermore, vitamin C has been shown to suppress the viral enzyme, reverse transcriptase, that allows viral DNA to reproduce itself. While these experimental studies do not provide clear guidelines for treating HIV-infected patients with vitamin C, they still indicate that achieving optimal concentrations of vitamin C in the body can inhibit HIV viral activity inside infected cells and preferentially kill or retard the proliferation of infected cells. Harake and Jarawala looked at the effects of vitamin C on the ability of HIV to replicate in chronically infected T lymphocytes. Their results further supported the potent antiviral activity of vitamin C. The authors also suggested that vitamin C had therapeutic value in controlling HIV infection. Harake and Jarawala later further investigated the ability of vitamin C to inhibit HIV activity in infected T lymphocyte cells. They reported that vitamin C appeared to facilitate this effect by a mechanism not shared with other antioxidants, which further supports the concept that vitamin C offers more benefit than just a potent antioxidant activity. Vitamin C has also been shown to help the clinical status of an HIV-infected patient by helping to repair damage that occurs as a side effect of drug therapy traditionally given to such patients. A frequent side effect of zidovudine, AZT, which is often used in the treatment of HIV-positive patients, is myopathy that is typically manifested as muscle weakness. De La Asuncion et al. Speculate that this myopathy is due largely to oxidative damage to the DNA found in the mitochondria in the muscle tissue. Mitochondria are the principal sites of cellular energy generation, accounting for muscular weakness perceived by a patient when their function is impaired. These researchers concluded that supranutritional dosing of vitamin C and vitamin E protected against AZT-mediated oxidative muscle damage in both AIDS patients and in mice treated with AZT. Gogu et al. Had earlier published that vitamin C alone also increased the therapeutic efficacy of AZT. Both vitamin C and vitamin E are antioxidants, which is probably why both lessen the toxicity of AZT. A myelopathy, or pathology of the spinal cord syndrome, is associated with human T lymphotrophic virus, type 1, HTLV-1. HTLV is often associated with HIV, existing as a co-infection. In fact, HTLV-3 was an early designation for HIV. Katawaka et al. Reported that 7 of 7 patients with myelopathy responded well to vitamin C therapy. Although it has already been stated that any form of stress, especially infective stress, will utilize and metabolize vitamin C at a greater rate, it is useful to note that this has been studied specifically in HIV infection. Treitinger et al. Found that HIV-infected patients had lower plasma concentrations of vitamin C than found in controls. Their results suggested that abnormalities of antioxidant defense were directly related to the progression of HIV infection. In similar fashion, Muller et al. Found that antioxidant supplementation with vitamin C and N-acetylcysteine for only 6 days in 8 HIV-infected patients had striking effects on certain immune functions and virus activity indicators. Specifically, in 5 patients who had the most advanced disease, the CD4 T lymphocyte count rose significantly, and the glutathione, another significant antioxidant content of those CD4 cells, also increased. Conversely, the plasma content of virus-related RNA declined. Everall et al. Found that AIDS patients who died of nervous system toxicity had significantly reduced levels of vitamin C in the most affected areas of the brain. As with other infective diseases, sufficient doses of vitamin C must be taken to deal with pre-existing depletions as well as to deal with the infection itself. Skernick et al. Reported that in a survey of HIV-positive patients and controls, almost a third of the HIV-positive patients had subnormal levels of one or more antioxidants, even though supplemental vitamins were being taken. Bogdan et al. Also reported that 27% of HIV-positive patients they studied had below normal plasma concentrations of vitamin C. Looking more generally at overall antioxidant levels, McLemore et al. Found that HIV-positive subjects had significantly lower levels than control subjects. Bagchi et al. Noted that AIDS is only one of many diseases with high levels of free radicals and antioxidant stress causing at least part of the clinical symptoms. The issue of supplementation is an especially important consideration when doing any kind of study on AIDS or other diseases. Vitamin C is very commonly taken currently as a supplement by millions of people, and many studies that look at the effects of different drugs on certain conditions never consider how diligently the patients are already self-medicating with vitamin C and other nutrients. Also, such patients often begin this vigorous supplementation immediately after they are first diagnosed, and this further obscures a determination of the singular effectiveness of any simultaneously prescribed medication. Modern medicine makes many claims as to the causes of improved clinical responses seen with many diseases today. It may well be that much of this improvement is due to increased self-dosing of vitamin C and other vital nutrients, as well as to the increased amounts of antioxidants and other nutrients being put into packaged foods. A reasonable conclusion would be that HIV infection and even full-blown AIDS are diseases that can be controlled quite effectively if a high enough chronic dosing of vitamin C is maintained. Indeed, with enough vitamin C, the evidence indicates that much of the disease pathology and many of the laboratory abnormalities can be reversed significantly or even normalized. Just as with all other viruses, there is also no reason not to believe that a high enough daily dose of vitamin C would prevent most HIV infections from ever even starting. Curing AIDS and HIV infection with vitamin C, however, remains yet to be clearly demonstrated. The unique nature of the HIV infection, with its dormancy in the CD4-positive lymphocytes, and very likely in other immune cells and tissues, makes the complete eradication of the infecting virus more difficult. Dental and other toxins that keep the immune system suppressed must first be properly removed. Once all readily removable toxicity is absent from the body, a prolonged series of high-dose intravenous injections of vitamin C, along with oral doses that approach bowel tolerance, may actually cure the HIV-infected patient. The common cold, Reversible and preventable. Curable? Question mark. The common cold is an acute viral disease typically characterized by cough, sore throat, and nasal symptoms, runny, difficult air passage. This disease is also known as acute coryza, or upper respiratory tract infection. Multiple viruses are capable of producing the common cold, and some of them do not produce an immunity, which subjects an individual to possible repeated infections with the same virus. As with most other viral infections, the medical textbook asserts that no antiviral agents are available for treating colds. The common cold is usually self-limited, with the most prominent symptoms characteristically persisting for about a week. Not uncommonly, however, significant colds can seriously depress the immune system and substantially deplete vitamin C stores in the body. Colds can lead to other superimposed infections or progress to additional organ involvement in the body, as is seen in some cases of viral pneumonia, encephalitis, or meningitis. Linus Pauling, the only individual to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, probably generated more attention in advocating high doses of vitamin C for the common cold than for anything else he did. It certainly brought him an enormous amount of criticism from members of the medical establishment. The book that Pauling wrote regarding vitamin C's beneficial effects on the common cold stimulated numerous subsequent publications on the subject. Unfortunately, Pauling's publication, and many others, did not look at dosing the common cold with the amounts of vitamin C that Klenner effectively used on so many different viruses. As already noted in this chapter, many of the viral diseases cured by Klenner with vitamin C were far more serious and had much greater viral loads spread throughout the body than seen with the common cold. However, a severe cold probably has a comparable viral load to an uncomplicated case of the flu, and Klenner demonstrated that curing the flu required substantially more vitamin C than recommended by Pauling for the common cold, and at least some of the vitamin C had to be injected rather than just taken orally. Nevertheless, Pauling was able to show a positive effect of vitamin C on the common cold with doses far lower than those utilized by Klenner. Cathcart, in describing his bowel tolerance method of determining the best doses of vitamin C for a given condition, discussed in his treatment of AIDS, found that colds seem to require much more vitamin C than was suggested in any published study before or since this observation. Specifically, Cathcart described a mild cold as typically requiring 30,000 to 60,000 milligrams of vitamin C to reach bowel tolerance. He also noted that a severe cold could require from 60,000 to more than 100,000 milligrams of vitamin C to reach bowel tolerance. Depending upon the amount required for bowel tolerance, Cathcart recommended administering the vitamin C in 6 to 15 divided doses daily to maintain optimal blood and body tissue levels. It should also be noted that Cathcart found that most normal adults without apparent infection or disease would tolerate from 4,000 to 15,000 milligrams of vitamin C before reaching bowel tolerance. In a review article, Himmila and Douglas noted that more than 60 studies on the effects of vitamin C on the common cold had been published as of the time of their writing. Douglas, et al., reviewed 30 studies looking at the effects of oral vitamin C in treating the common cold. They concluded that although colds were not prevented by the doses of vitamin C given, a modest benefit of reduced symptom duration was seen, and some of the evidence indicated that larger doses resulted in even greater benefits. Himmila earlier reviewed 21 placebo-controlled studies examining the effects of vitamin C on the common cold performed since 1971. He concluded that vitamin C consistently lessened cold symptoms, but did not reduce the incidence of the common cold. The daily doses in these studies were either equal to or somewhat in excess of 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. In terms of disease duration and severity of symptoms, an average of 23% reduction was observed. Gorton and Jarvis designed a prospective controlled study to look at how effective vitamin C would be in both preventing and relieving symptoms of already contracted colds and flu. A test group was compared with a control group. The test group regularly received 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C 3 times a day. If cold or flu symptoms developed in the test group, 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C was immediately given hourly for the first 6 hours, and the maintenance schedule was resumed. Relative to the control group, the cold and flu symptoms in the vitamin C receiving test group were decreased by 85%. This study is also significant in that the importance of a loading dose of vitamin C above and beyond a maintenance dose was recognized. Although the dose sizes were still well below those routinely used by Klenner and were given orally rather than intravenously, this study, when compared to most of the earlier vitamin C cold studies, helps to independently establish the importance of acutely giving a larger dose of vitamin C. After the loading dose has been administered, one may proceed to a maintenance dose in order to achieve clinical benefit. Karlofsky et al. Published a study from the National Institutes of Health that has long served to supposedly debunk the idea that vitamin C is of definite use in treating the common cold. Camilla, in analyzing the oft-cited results of Karlofsky et al., found that the study actually showed a 17% decrease in the duration of colds in those patients given an additional 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily to an existing maintenance dose of 3,000 milligrams daily. Karlofsky and his co-workers had dismissed this as being secondary to the placebo effect. They concluded this because the placebo had a different taste from the vitamin C. Camilla points out that this placebo explanation is not likely valid, since the decrease in symptoms very closely paralleled the decreases seen in other studies with non-detectable placebos. Also, the 17% improvement is very close to the average 23% improvement seen in the series of 21 placebo-controlled studies referred to by Camilla. Carr et al. Also generated data consistent with the finding noted earlier. They looked at the effects of vitamin C on the common cold using identical twins as controls. It was concluded that the vitamin C was effective in shortening the average duration of cold episodes by 19%. Murphy et al. Looked at the effects of vitamin C in alleviating the symptoms of a virus that could cause cold-like symptoms in the marmoset, a primate susceptible to cold viruses of human origin. The mean body weight of the animals was 400 grams, and the vitamin C supplemented animals received 100 milligrams of vitamin C twice a day orally, which would equate to approximately 35,000 milligrams daily for a 70 kilogram man. The authors concluded that while the vitamin C did not prevent virus infection, it did delay the onset of disease, reduce clinical symptoms, and decrease the chances of death from the infection. Edwards treated cats with feline rhinotracheitis, a type of viral cold, with vitamin C. A 1,000 milligram daily dose of vitamin C was given intravenously until clinical recovery, and then 250 milligrams daily oral doses were continued for a few days after recovery. The average recovery time for the treated cats was 4.9 days, compared to 13 days for the untreated controls. Povey also reported on the treatment of feline viral rhinotracheitis with vitamin C. Although Povey used much smaller daily doses of vitamin C, 100 milligrams, than Edwards, Povey was still able to assert that there was some evidence that these high levels of vitamin C were shortening recovery times. Belfield and Stone reported on the vitamin C treatment of a Siamese cat that was very ill with rhinotracheitis. The initial dose of vitamin C was 8,000 milligrams intravenously, 1,000 milligrams per pound of body weight, in 2 divided doses. 2 more 4,000 milligram injections were given after the first day, and 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams were also given orally daily in the cat's food. The cat recovered quickly, and the authors asserted that they had similarly successfully treated about 100 cases like this one. There is certainly no reason to believe that the viruses responsible for the common cold would respond any less positively to the large doses of vitamin C used by Klenner for the other viral diseases that he successfully treated. If one wanted to recover from a cold in 72 hours or less, significant doses of intravenous vitamin C would typically have to be part of the protocol. A very light cold, treated very promptly with bowel tolerance doses of vitamin C, would also likely be cured in 72 hours or less. However, once the viral load has been allowed to become substantially large, initial dosing should be intravenous in order to quickly get ahead of the virus. While the literature does not directly assure that the common cold is curable with vitamin C, the indirect evidence would indicate that this is the case. The symptoms definitely show reversibility with adequate doses of vitamin C, and taking daily bowel tolerance doses of vitamin C should suffice in preventing most colds from ever being contracted. A recently developed form of oral vitamin C, encapsulated in liposomes, is now demonstrating superior bioavailability and clinical response relative to intravenous vitamin C. Ebola virus. Curable? Reversible? Preventable? Due to news coverage in recent years that seems designed to induce fear that a new uncontrollable killer virus has suddenly appeared, Ebola virus is now generally well known throughout the world. Ebola is probably the best known of a class of viruses known as hemorrhagic fever viruses. In fact, Ebola virus was initially recognized in 1976. Other less known but related viral syndromes include yellow fever, dengue hemorrhagic fever, Rift Valley fever, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, Kiasiner Forest disease, Omsk hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome, hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, Venezuelan hemorrhagic fever, Brazilian hemorrhagic fever, Argentine hemorrhagic fever, Bolivian hemorrhagic fever, and Lassa fever. The Ebola virus infection, also known as African hemorrhagic fever, has the distinction of having the highest case fatality rate of the viral infections noted earlier, ranging from 53% to 88%. These viral hemorrhagic fever syndromes share certain clinical features. The Cecil Textbook of Medicine notes that these diseases are characterized by capillary fragility, which translates to easy bleeding, that can frequently lead to severe shock and death. These diseases also tend to consume and or destroy the platelets, which play an integral role in blood clotting. The clinical presentation of these viral diseases is similar to scurvy, which is also characterized by capillary fragility and a tendency to bleed easily. Characteristic skin lesions develop, which are actually multiple tiny areas of bleeding into the skin that surround the hair follicles. Some cases even include bleeding into already healed scars. In the classic form of scurvy that evolves very slowly from the gradual depletion of vitamin C body stores, the immune system will be sufficiently compromised for infection to claim the patient's life before the extensive hemorrhage that occurs after all vitamin C stores have been completely exhausted. Ebola virus and the other viral hemorrhagic fevers are much more likely to cause hemorrhaging before any other fatal infection has a chance to become established. This is because the virus so rapidly and totally metabolizes and consumes all available vitamin C in the bodies of the victims that an advanced stage of scurvy is literally produced after only a few days of the disease. The scurvy is so complete that the blood vessels generally cannot keep from hemorrhaging long enough to allow an infective complication to develop. Also, the viral hemorrhagic fevers typically only take hold and reach epidemic proportions in those populations that would already be expected to have low body stores of vitamin C, such as is found in many of the severely malnourished Africans. In such individuals, Any infecting hemorrhagic virus will often wipe out any remaining vitamin C stores before the immune systems can get the upper hand and initiate recovery. When the vitamin C stores are rapidly depleted by large infecting doses of an aggressive virus, the immune system gets similarly depleted and compromised. However, this point is largely academic. After